Welcome to Roll Better, not an actual play, just a podcast about actually playing, where we focus on becoming better tabletop role players and creating a funner, more fun, I think it is, creating a more fun and more engaging experience for everyone at the table. I'm Miranda.
And I'm Nate, your funner partner.
And we're back with a hot, fresh Roll Better rule for you. We won't recap these all of the time, but we only have two rules so far, so I think that we can manage. Rule one was to talk to the other players, and now rule two is to play with the toys in front of you. Nate, what the hell does that mean?
Oh, play with the toys in front of you. I think that's, we just talked about that. That's a two-parter, Miranda. It's got two sort of aspects that I think we want to touch on. And one is all about creation. And sort of limits and playing within limits. And the other one is all about the game system and playing within the limits and enjoying and figuring out how to make games out of those limits. Miranda, you ever had a dog? You've had dogs. You ever had a dog that has...
I have three dogs currently.
16 dogs in the home. I've got two. Mm-hmm. But you ever had a dog that has like the toy chest and has a bunch
My
of toys
dogs currently have
in the toy chest? Yes. Okay, so this is like a thing that some dogs do, where you have a dog and they have the toy chest, and the toy chest is just full of toys, and the dog decides, oh, I want to play, so I'm going to grab a toy out of the toy chest, and then grab another toy out of the toy chest, and then keep grabbing toys out of... Do you have a dog like that?
Nate, I have a 7-month-old husky that you're describing my life right now.
So I think sometimes we see this when we play games. We become that dog taking toys out of the toy chest. We don't actually start playing with any of those toys. We just keep taking new toys out. And in my head, what I've called this and what I've seen this called is overcreation. And so part of play with the toys in front of you is a don't overcreate rule. And what does that mean? Well, what's creating? So don't overcreate. So what's creating when we're playing a game? Creation is any time you introduce something as a player and that becomes real. Or air quotes real in a game. That's creation. It's basic. It's exactly what it sounds like. Your character's background or your history, your character's beliefs or their ideals, the things that they're passionate about, the betrayals that happened that drive them to action, or the stuff in their pockets, stuff in the backpack, the way that they've decorated their apartment or their lair or their secret hideout, whatever, all that stuff, that's creation. Which is good and fun. But when you're playing, what we're talking about and what we're going to try and describe today is this idea of playing with the toys in front of you, creating a limited amount, and then trying to figure out how to play with that limited amount to the maximum amount of fun. I don't know if that makes any sense.
I think it makes sense. It's funny because I feel like in our episode with Rena and our first episode, we talked more about creation and talking to other players, how you can add stuff to the game, how you can bring out your character's background. Rena had interview questions and how you could eat favorite sandwich, all of those things that you could come up with. And it sounds like what you're saying is, yes, the creation part is part of the fun, but then you have to use those things. Don't just throw them out there and then forget about them. If you put that out there, use it and make it meaningful.
Yes, yes. And the only reason I think this is an interesting rule and one I want to talk about, or one aspect of this rule that I want to talk about, is I fully believe and I've seen that when we get into a situation, we might be nervous. And a lot of times let's face it, playing a role-playing game and role-playing with strangers or at a convention or with your friends, like there's some nerves to that, right? There's some stresses. There's some, I don't know. When we get nervous, we humans gravitate towards certain things. One of the things we gravitate towards is creation. Another thing we gravitate towards is blue humor, sex and swearing and all of that. It's comfortable. But one of the things that we do when we're nervous is we create, we make stuff up over and over and over. And so one of the reasons I want to talk about the rule is more of identifying this aspect of nature where, oh, I'm nervous. So when I'm nervous and I'm role-playing, I'm just going to start spewing left and right, nonstop new things. And why do I do that? Well, part of it's that stress reaction. It's the same reason that sometimes you might keep talking until you're out of breath. And you know that you're out of breath And so you keep talking and you're trying to catch your breath, but you're nervous. So you keep, or maybe it's because you're nervous. So you freeze. You don't say anything at the table. You don't raise your hand. You're desperately hoping someone tells you exactly what to do. Like these natural ways that you respond to stress. And so this is one thing to identify and look at. And the solution, it's not a problem to fix, but one of the things that you can do is if you notice that and identify the fact that, oh, when I'm nervous, I create, I just make things up, new stuff constantly. If you can stop yourself and then turn your game around into, well, geez, how do I actually use the thing that I just created for the next 30 minutes? How do I make that the thing that the game is about? How do I make that the thing my character is focused and fixated on? How did that stupid catchphrase that came out, I blurted out of my mouth for some reason, and I have no idea why. Well, how do I use that five more times over the next hour of play instead of making my character the one that just creates a brand new catchphrase every single time? Which I think is more natural when you're stressed. And this is not a call out. This is stuff that I do all the time. This is stuff I've seen you do. Like it's not, oh, you're bad if you do that. This is a, hey, check this out. Identify this. Look at this comma behavior and see if you want to maybe play with that in a different way. Notice it and play with it a different way.
Yeah, as a convicted rambler and over-explainer, I do feel both seen and attacked right now. But it's funny you said catchphrase and it made me think of the They Came From games, which I love kind of about that, because it gives you creation tools to play with. It gives you, you have catchphrases and things that you're trying to say over and over and over again. Yes. And using that same phrase. And it has kind of those built-in tropey things where you're going to do the same thing multiple times and it's going to be funnier each time that you do it. And I love when that comes up in games, when something is funny and we all laugh at it and then it comes up again and again and it becomes this through line that kind of holds the story together.
It's the same reason maybe callbacks are so satisfying when they happen in a group. It just feels like, oh, wow, you've created something. You did something together, unintentional, unplanned, but you did. And then, and that there's, I mean, it's not, it's pretty common. There's the rule of three that shows up a lot. And the rule of three shows up in writing, in script writing, in all sorts of creative pursuits. But I think it shows up in the stupid little RPG improv play that we do as well, where you do something and then you do that exact same thing again. And it's sort of, maybe it's awkward. And then you do it a third time and all of a sudden it's hilarious again. And then you do it again and again and it's like, okay, give it up. And the third time it's all of a sudden hilarious again. And I've seen this play out in so many games. People that have no idea, they're not, and people aren't trying to use this necessarily. Maybe they are, but, and even when I know, oh, this is a rule of three. And then the third time it happens, I don't know, invariably I'm cracking up and it pisses me off because I feel like, well, I'm just such a simple machine that can be programmed like this. But yeah, I think it's something that we can use. It's fun to create. And so don't get me wrong. Like this isn't a, hey, stop creating kind of thing, because it's fun to do that. And that's part of the reason why we play these games. For some people, it's easier just to make something up in the moment than try and figure out how you want to, I don't know, carefully or maybe intentionally, thematically bring something that you introduced at the beginning of the game over and over into all these different situations that are showing up. It's more challenging sometimes. But like a callback, rule of three, it can be so satisfying to make that happen. I'm thinking of a They Came From game that we played. Might have been our first one in. At some point, we're introducing characters and someone said something to me. And so I decided that my character at that moment, you love this bit too.
I remember exactly what
or whatever,
it was.
And I don't even remember what the inciting incident was, but oh, my character doesn't recognize women. And not like, oh, I don't, that character doesn't view women as equal. No, my character didn't see women.
I believe the other character, I don't know if they tried to imply that you were a womanizer or it was they were hitting on you.
Okay.
It was something like they were implying something about your character and you rebelled against that very hard.
Okay. But I remember I did. So I made this choice. Oh, I don't recognize women. And not that, no, I just don't see them. And at that moment I thought, but what if that's true? What if this character actually doesn't see women? Let's play with that. And it was a terrible decision, but it was also hilarious to try and play. Cause we were in, where do we go to? We went to a freaking nunnery, I believe.
Yep. Yeah. You were at a nunnery.
And so this is my character. I've introduced this. Okay, Miranda, where's the first scene? Oh, you're in this convent full of nuns. Oh shit. What am I going to do now? Figuring out what to do with that while not blocking the game, while not just abandoning the game, was a lot of fun.
When you found ways to engage with it consistently, but not all the time.
Yes.
So the first few times that, a woman approached you, you did not see them. But then later you would engage with female NPCs and other female characters because it was hard.
I got too hard. Like, I can't do this. I'm not smart enough to play this out completely.
Well, it just wouldn't have been fun. But then at opportune or inopportune moments, it would kick back in. You have those callbacks to it. So you committed to the bit just enough to make it a commitment without it being just totally tedious for everyone else at the table.
That's a whole different rule that we'll probably talk about. Try not to be so tedious to the table that they don't invite you back.
Exactly. This does bring up something else, though, and I think it falls into this as I'm listening to you talk about creating and how we create. Eventually, you have to engage with what's happening. And I think sometimes when a game stalls out, it's because we are doing too much creation. In that we're investigating so much that we want to find everything. We want to have every single piece of the puzzle. We want all of the yarn lines on the board, all of the whole thing filled, but we aren't engaging with the game then because we're so busy finding and creating those pieces. And this is kind of that over-creation piece that eventually you just have to run towards the danger.
Mm-hmm.
Creating is great and it can make for some fun scenes, but it doesn't always progress the story forward. That over-creation piece can stall something out. And so by using what you have and engaging with the story, you can move the story forward in a fun way.
Mm-hmm. I think that's so important. That ties back in my mind to the gifts that you give other players and the gifts players give you when you're playing. And gifts are things that you can use to interact. So if I say, oh, my character's X, that's a gift I've given you. If you say, oh, my character loves this, that's a gift you've given me. That's great. If you go to a birthday party, you get 500 gifts. That's not great. Maybe if you can sell them on eBay, that's great. But it's not great because you can't really appreciate all 500. You can't really engage with, can you imagine the first one? You're like, oh, this is so perfect. This teapot, I'm going to put this up on my shelf. Really reminds me of my Aunt Helda. We used to do tea parties and that was something. And then you've got 499 other gifts that you've got to open and play out stories to that. No, that's not going to happen. And so limiting and engaging with the story by not flooding it with all this other stuff. Yeah, that's an important aspect of being a player that is creating an environment others can actually survive in and engage in on the other side.
And there are games that are more geared towards creation too, like GM-less games or games that rely on players contributing to the story more, that if that's a piece that you like, is adding all of that stuff and that becoming a bigger part of the game, search out those games too. Like, I think Triangle Agency is a good example of this because there's so much of players manipulating reality and that contributing to the story that creation becomes a really big part of the story.
What's Triangle Agency for me? I've only played it with you like four or five times, so I have no memory of it. What? Tell me about it.
So Triangle Agency is a game where you are playing government agents in with secret powers. Like, you have superhuman powers where you can manipulate reality. And when you go out to fight, it's kind of a monster of the week type deal where you're fighting something each week. And when you go out to battle these anomalies, the way that you address them is by altering reality. Maybe you're slowing down time. Maybe you're having the agency make a piano fall on something in the street, blocking people from going in, which is kind of interesting and unique in a way for stories. But
it can be challenging because you realize, whoa,
it's so hard.
I have that much freedom. I can't have that much freedom.
Yes.
There must be some restrictions that I have to play within.
It has its own mechanics that have consequences yes. for your creations, which I feel like this all kind of ties into the other side of the coin that is the second rule, which is buying into the game.
So what is that about? So playing with the toys in front of you, this other side of this coin, buy into the game you're playing. What's that about?
So buying into the game is acknowledging the system of the game, acknowledging the structure of the game, and then committing to playing within that system and exploring that system and the expectations of the system. For example, I just brought up Monster of the Week style of games, including the game Monster of the Week, where you know that your games are going to be episodic, that something bad is going to be happening in a town. You'll get called out to that town or you'll be addressing that town. You're going to find clues to what this monster, I'm doing air quotes, but you can't see it because this is an audio format, what that monster is, and then you will address that issue and everything will be wrapped up before dinner. From 6 p.m. to 7 p.m., this will be wrapped up on our episode, Monster of the Week style. But knowing that and committing to that is the type of game that we're going to play, and not feeling like the rule system is constricting you, but that it is giving you a arena in which you can really play around with those tropes, mm-hmm. that you can play around with the rules that they have, and that you can make that fun, exaggerated. You can make kind of take this example of a type of system and exaggerate it in a really fun way.
So players, gamers, especially on the internet, talk a lot about railroading, mm-hmm. talk a lot about player agency, talk a lot about those concepts. And what I'm hearing you say is, look, yes, there is railroading, there's player agency. Those are things that exist and are valid. But let's talk about the system first. What kind of game are you playing? Are you playing a game like Monster of the Week where you are introduced to the thing, you do some research on the thing, you figure out how the thing works, and then you end that thing within one session? If that is the structure of the game, it's not necessarily railroading when your game runner for Monster of the Week says, well, no, you can't go off to Japan to do this internship, your character, even though it's very important, because you have to stay in Fowlerville, Illinois, where this thing is terrorizing the electric grid. Like, that's not railroading, that is buying into the game. Two of our favorites, Call of Cthulhu and Delta Green. Lots of overlap, tons of thematic overlap, somewhat different systems. Mm-hmm. And when you play one, there's expectations. Like Delta Green, I sort of expect to have some power, some ability to fight, some ability to put things down, and my character will probably end up horribly changed or dead. Call of Cthulhu, I expect to have less power. Maybe I have no idea what's going on, or even if I do, I don't have much I can do against it. I'm going to do more investigation, and my character will probably end horribly changed or maybe dead. But if I go into those games and I want to play them like a different game, I don't know if I have success. I don't know if I bring to the table something that's fun for everyone. Maybe it's fun for me. And I think it's more fun if you understand what the game is and buy into that game. Or you don't like that game, play the one that actually has the mechanics and the thing that you want, that you like to do more of.
Yeah, if you, in Call of Cthulhu, want to play a player that, or an investigator that confronts the mythos, that knows about the mythos, that knows that these things exist and engage with them, Delta Green. But when I think of Call of Cthulhu, and yes, there are things, I mean, I played a fortune teller. Okay, she wasn't really a fortune teller. She's totally a con artist. But so there are characters that maybe have inklings. You have had some experience with the mythos in the past. And I've played characters that have been touched by the mythos, have had very brief, but they didn't really know about the mythos. They didn't know this broader scope of things. And I think that's more fun to engage with and more in the spirit of Call of Cthulhu. The spirit, I feel like, of Call of Cthulhu is you are up against these unknown, nameless horrors. You are mostly helpless. Sure, one person probably survives in the end, but you aren't meant to. I feel like you're meant to fight. You're not meant to survive.
Yes, and even if you survive, it's probably not a happy ending. That's part of the fun of a lot of Cthulhu games is the epilogue that you get to give for your character. And a lot of times it's the ending part, or it's how your character struggles through the rest of their existence, horribly changed. There's another aspect. So this, getting back to you, if you play within the system, you try to find the games within the system. Try to find how to play within the limits, within the constraints. And so a lot of times we're playing these made up things that are happening in the real world. Mythos, Delta Green, there's, kids on bikes. They came from there's sort of a modern or a realistic world. It's not D&D. It's a realistic world, but non-realistic things are happening. So you have skeptics, of course. And one of the things that I like to say is the skeptic played as the skeptic is one of the least interesting things to interact with in a game like that. I don't want to play opposite someone who's doing really well at playing someone who doesn't believe in what we're dealing with and is disconnecting from it. I'm going to go home. Nope, I don't care. But what is hilarious and super fun is the skeptic who, because of their skepticism, is engaging and diving into that mythos, that supernatural, that aspect of it in a completely ridiculous way or an unwise way or a dangerous way. Why? Because they're skeptics. So they don't really believe that if you come in contact with that black goo that just spilled out of that body, there's a scientific reason, and that's not actually an organism that's going to take over their brain and do stuff. So I'm going to go swim in it just to show you, because I'm such a skeptic. There's ways to figure out how to play within the constraints and play any kind of character, any kind of game. And that's part of the fun.
On the Misconic Playhouse, I played in a game, Castle of Greed. And in Castle of Greed, I played a psychologist, which I never do because that's entirely too close to home for me. But I played a psychologist, and she was obviously a skeptic. She was a woman of science, and we were confronted with a
woman. So my example for that
needed to complete, we're talking about completing a ritual. And I could say, that's not real. This is all in her head. The ritual's not going to do anything, all of these things. And instead, I twisted it and said, we do need to do the ritual. And I committed to doing this ritual that I knew would probably go pretty horribly, because I don't think that what she thinks is real. It's all psychosomatic. And doing this ritual will make her feel better because she'll have played out whatever these feelings are. And so I flipped it around, my skepticism and my non-belief, into I'm going to go along with it, even though I don't believe in it. And I have a reason for going along with it.
So you were able to use your skeptic side, your skepticism, your character skepticism, to actually increase the action and to increase the danger, increase the risk.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And that's fun.
I think a good example of a game that really requires people to buy into it is Paranoia, which people either love or hate. There's not a lot of in between, I think. People get really excited about it, or they do not want to play it at all. And I think because it does have the capability of being very frustrating for some people, because it's a game where things are meant to be put in your way that are difficult to get around and that take a lot of creative thinking. And sometimes even when you try your best and do really good, you will fail, because it is a game where the GM is kind of against you.
So this is one I actually haven't ever played for real. What's the theme of this?
The theme of Paranoia is futuristic. The world essentially is run by a computer that runs things very efficiently inefficient. And so it's very bureaucratic. And you are low level in it a lot of times.
So this just sounds like real life. It sounds awful. This is awful.
It does. It's awful. And you're trying to do things with secret societies. And I think the perfect example of where people get frustrated, and it's in the book, it's an obstacle you can, they suggest you put in player's way, is you need to get from point A to point B. You have red level clearance. That is a blue hallway. How do you get through the blue hallway? You can't go through the blue hallway. And players really have to buy into, this is going to be frustrating. It's going to be bureaucratic. It's going to be silly. And if you don't, if that's not your style of game, or you can't buy into that rule set, it's going to be very frustrating, because you want to, you know, possibly very clearly have, I do A, B, C, I roll well and everything's fine. You may do A, B, C and roll well, and the friend computer still kills you because you've committed treason somehow. So that is a game that I think really at a higher level requires that player buy-in piece.
We're talking a lot about sort of these story games or these role-playing games. I think this applies just as much to our traditional power fantasy games. D&D is a power fantasy game.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole point of D&D is to get more powerful so you can win at harder and harder challenges. I think Pathfinder's similar. I think many of those power fantasy games are very similar. And what I see is folks sometimes equate RPGs overall with that, and they try to take that into all games. Not all games are about winning, and not all the fun in these games is about winning. A lot of times, all of the fun are in the lose scenarios or in the alternate scenarios where you failed to do that. And so I think one of the things you can do as a player also is sample and taste some of these other systems. You know, you don't have to live a system. It doesn't have to be an identity. It can just be something you do once at a convention, or you buy it from your game shop and you try and play it once with your group of friends or whatever, just to sample and see all these different ways to play. I like to do that too. I know you're a fan of this, this short, like one pager or very short, almost sometimes very silly, sometimes not, but like, and Grant Howitt out there has made many of them. And I always think about Honey Heist.
Yep.
I don't like that game.
Why?
Like Honey Heist is not a game that I enjoy.
Okay.
And Honey Heist is a game that I've enjoyed playing every single time I've played it.
Okay.
And it's, so when I think about it and I look at it, I'm like, this is overly, so there's like three rules. There's nothing going on with your character. You're not building a character, really. You're throwing some dice and there's some random attributes.
You have a hat.
There's a hat. You're like, what the heck do you do with that hat? The whole game.
Oh, so you do so many things with the hat. The hat really comes
into
play.
Figuring out, yes, how much you can do with these two or three really dumb, you play as a bear. You're in a random location with random security to try and steal honey. And you have a couple aspects of the bear. And one of them is the hat that you have. How the heck do you play? It's so fun. And I really dislike it when I read it every single time. Like, this is not going to be fun, but it's an exercise, an activity, and it's practice. And it also is, I think it reveals how much fun you can have within those constraints and how much fun you can have when you're not trying to play a certain kind of game. You're just trying to dive into what is in front of you and play with the toys that you have. Those hats, man, they are always the key.
They are. I love exploring new games. If you are having difficulty finding a group to play games with, run a game. For as much as you can learn from playing a game and from experiencing different games, the amount of experience and just learning you get with running a game, I know it's nerve-wracking. I tell people, I get sweaty every time, and I tell my table every single time that I'm nervous and sweaty when I'm running a new game. That's okay. You will gain so much from running a game. Pick a one-pager, real easy rules, and run it. Just do it.
100% agree.
I do have a confession, Nate.
Another one.
So we're talking about buying into the system, buying into the game, playing with the tools you have. I have a confession that I was once and only one time ever a bad player in a game.
No.
Absolutely. Yes, I was. I've learned so many things since then. But okay, so here's the story. A friend of ours was running a game of Alien for myself and some other people. In my infinite hilarity, refused, and this story comes up semi-regularly, I refused to engage with the game. It was a game of Alien. I refuse to engage with the story. At one point, I shut myself in a room and engaged in a game of two truths and a lie over an intercom with another player.
And that wasn't related in any way to what was happening in Alien.
I think there was scary stuff happening.
And then your character's voice would show up over the intercom to play two truths and a lie.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. So I did not engage with the game. Mm-hmm. I had played Alien before, so I knew the game system. I was not buying into the running towards danger. I did not engage at all with any aliens or other players that weren't on an intercom. And it was funny. In the moment, it was funny for me.
You were having a blast.
I had a great time being a total asshole. I don't think it was made for the most fun. But it was fun for me, and it was fun in the moment. I could have made that game so much more fun for other people by engage. And this is kind of along the line with the skeptic thing. Yeah, if an alien was attacking whatever fucking ship we're on, I would hide and talk to people over the intercom.
That is a very smart thing to do in the real life situation when you are actually in a spaceship and you are actually being attacked by an alien. Yes, I agree with you.
Not in a game. In a game, it is funny for me. And other people laughed. Yes. I don't know how committed
was
they were to my
bit. Was it uncomfortable, awkward laughter to try and...
You know, hindsight, yeah. I don't really remember. But it did not make the most fun at the table. And I will admit that. Yeah. At one time, I was a bad player. So I wanted to give an anti-example from all the examples that we have made. That sometimes this experience that's the most fun for you, and we've talked about this, like making more fun for everyone at the table. In that moment, that was the most fun thing for me to do because I knew the game runner and I, you know, could give him a hard time.
Are you still friendds though? Or did that end the friendship?
Hope so.
Are you sure?
I think
are
so. You sure? I like to think so. You may never know. But at the time it was fun for me.
Yeah.
I don't think I made the most fun for everyone at the table.
Yeah. Well, that's why we're doing this. This isn't a judgment. These aren't actual rules for living, and don't break them. I think you're allowed to sometimes just take some fun for yourself.
Be an asshole?
Yeah, be an asshole. You deal with the consequences, ramifications. Choose the table. I mean, I might admit to doing that once or twice. There's a group that I do a monthly game with, and now you do a monthly game with that same group. And that group, a lot of it is just that. Every single person's doing their own thing. I remember a session where I was having a great conversation. There's four of us. Is it four or five? Five of us?
There's five of us now.
But I was having a hell of a conversation with one of the other players while you and another player were having the time of your life off screwing around for like almost an entire session.
That feels right.
That's fine, because that's sort of the group that is. And that you do that at a convention, you do that with some strangers, the pickup, you do that, you run the risk of not being fun for anyone. So yeah, I think it's fine.
Sub rule, I think we're on, if we're adding to the bottom list, I think we're on 72, which is know your table.
Know your table.
Is now rule 72. When we get to it in 6 years, know your table. So there you go. So we should recap.
Recap. Go ahead.
Rule two is to play with the toys in front of you. And it's a two-parter. One being don't over-create. Build some stuff and then play with it. Bring it back up. Remember the rule of three. Play with what you have been given. And the second part of that is buying into the game. Play with the rules that you're given and within the sandbox that you're given. And you will have more fun if you commit to the themes and tropes of that style of game.
100%.
Nailed it.
I like it.
Thanks.
Thank you, Miranda, for that recap.
You're welcome. And join us next time, whenever we release this podcast again, for another rule.
When in doubt, heighten.
It's been fun recording, Nate.
Miranda, it's been lovely, as always.
Thank you. I'm sure.
Appreciate you.
Bye, Nate.
Bye.